Okay, now for today's Dharma talk. What day is it today? Hey, I'm sure you all know. Yeah, it's good. It's now day. Very good. So, it's getting close to the time when we leave here and we go back to our various destinations. And usually, it is this time we answer all those questions which some people ask in the last interviews or put down on those pieces of papers. When you get home, and it's not the same as supporting structure for meditation, what do you do to keep up the momentum so you don't lose what you've gained on this retreat? And what strategies can you actually put in place? And what does this all mean anyway? So during this retreat, because this will be the last major talk which I give on this retreat, there'll be a little bit of a chit-chat just after lunch. But the major thing which I've taught on this retreat is the ability for people to get into these wonderful, peaceful states without any effort at all. It's actually showing that this path of samadhi is a very, in a sense, an easy path if one can learn how to turn off that switch of doing. It gives you a very deep insight into the path of the Buddha. And I often go back to the story before the Buddha's enlightenment, striving, 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 never led him to enlightenment. But instead he found this beautiful middle way, which you've been trying to just to get just right during this retreat. And when you do actually just tweak it just right, get the right level of non-effort, non-interference, many of you have found the mind gets very peaceful very easily. It just does it naturally. The mind gets soft, the mind gets peaceful, the mind gets still, and you're quite happily sitting there meditating, and for much longer than you've ever meditated before, without any effort, without any striving. And that should have shown you something, something very important, that just this way to peace is a way of letting go. And it gives you a deeper understanding of why the Buddha taught something like the Four Noble Truths. I always mention the Second Noble Truth and the Third Noble Truth. The Second Noble Truth is the cause of suffering. And the Buddha always said that's craving, striving. And the end of suffering is called like letting go, freedom, contentment. And if you really study those Second and Third Noble Truths, you find that that's exactly what you've been doing this meditation retreat. At least that's what you did if there was any success in the meditation. Every time you strive and try to get somewhere, try to push, you usually get tense, the mind gets a bit crazy, and you never get anywhere. As soon as you really turn on that letting go button, you just be content. Oh, my mind's crazy, that's fine. Whatever's happening, that's okay with me. You're in the present moment where no craving can live. And you find everything gets so peaceful and nice. You understand the path to end craving. And so those are things which, great deep insights which you get from this meditation retreat. You can listen to the Four Noble Truths. For all your life, you can read all the books, you can listen to all the lectures, but nothing is worth just a little bit of experience of what this is all about. And especially those of you who had the good fortune to actually get into deep states of meditation, even actually states of, you know, very peaceful, beautiful breath, or even the nimittas, or even beyond, you can understand the profundity of this path, just why this path of meditation has been central to Buddhism for 2,600 years. And why it's not a theory, but it's something which you can really practice. And it's not just something which just takes you to nirvana, because on the way to nirvana, it just enhances the quality of one's life, and it also enhances one's ability to contribute in life. The more that one knows how to get still, just the more efficient, the more one can do in one's daily life. Because you'll find when you get back home, and you get back to work, you find your mind is more sharp, more focused, more concentrated, much easier to handle stress. In fact, there was one lady who comes to Perth, and she told me once that she had an interview for this very difficult executive job, high-flying job, and at the interviews, I think she got to a final interview about three or four others. What got her the job was when she put in her CV that she was a meditator. Oh, you're a meditator. You get the job. Because the people knew that she could handle stress. And it was a very stressful job. So So these are little things you know from, you know, the stories of life. But learning how to meditate in this particular way will actually make you a better human being, more efficient at work, and a kinder, more gentle human being to live with for your fellow companions in life. And I mentioned that in one of the question times, that so often it's the case that you may not fully recognize how much this meditation changes you, but other people see it. And other people just see that, and they just very value what you've done and how you've changed in the space of 9 days. One of the first meditation retreats which I did was up in Scotland. And after finishing the retreat, I never realized just how calm and quiet I'd become, because everybody else in the retreat was also getting, you know, reasonably calm, reasonably quiet. And then when I actually got in the car to get a lift back to London, it was crazy. It was just the whole scene of like cars whizzing past when you stop for gas in a petrol station. You couldn't believe just the volume and the speed of people's speech. And it was actually grating on the ears. It's something terrible. And it took me, you know, a day or two to come back down and to be able to accommodate to that degree of intensity of sense perception. And you'll find that when you get out of here. Which is why I always advise people who've been on retreat, if you're driving home, just take a few laps around the car park or go up one of the side streets before you try and negotiate one of the main roads. Otherwise, you'll be driving along there, oh, let it go, let go, let go, let go. And you're sort of at that red traffic light and you think, oh, this is really nice, it changes to green, oh, never mind, it will pass. And everyone else behind you starts to beat their horns and get really crazy. So you have to actually sharpen up, you know, your reflexes when you go outside, because it's a much harder and quicker world. So give yourself a bit of time to adjust, but also notice what's happened to you. You have slowed down a lot. And in that slowing down, there's been huge benefits. Health benefits will always come from slowing down. Everybody knows that stress increases one's inability to accommodate to the things like the diseases and viruses of life. The more you can relax, the better your immune system becomes, the easier you heal. I know many people. I remember this one lady who had a breast cancer, had her breast removed, but she was meditating on the wound. And the doctors couldn't believe how fast it healed and how well it healed. Extraordinarily fast. And that was the only thing she was doing, just giving it kindness, giving it space, giving it peace. Giving the body a chance to work instead of reacting over much to the wounds or the aches in your body. And so you find your health improves enormously. One of our monks, very many years ago, we'd always go and give blood and donate blood to the Red Cross. And one day he went there to give blood, and the nurse took his blood pressure, but he was like a regular donor. And even when he was working, he used to give blood. And she noticed that he changed, or the blood pressure had gone down quite considerably. So much so, she remarked on it, because, you know, he'd actually been working in the State Energy Corporation before, in a sort of a high-flying job. And the nurse said, hey, your blood pressure's gone right down. What are you doing? And she took one look at him in his monk's robes and said, you haven't been meditating, have you? And that was the conversation. She said, of course, I'm a monk. She said, oh, that's it. And she understood that by a little bit of meditation, your blood pressure goes down. You get peace. You get stillness. And so you find that if you meditate, you can actually lessen many of your health bills. In fact, and this is a fact which I heard from the monks in our monastery in California, if you can get a monk or some sort of priest, some sort of authority, to sign a statutory declaration that you are a meditator, you will receive a reduction in the health premium you have to pay every year for your health cover. It's true. The reason is because everybody knows, it's a fact, that if you meditate, you have better health. So you cost the health funds much less. So the next time we have a retreat, this retreat should be sponsored by the health department of Western Australia. So, because it's saving the health department, the government money. Not so many people go to hospitals when you come here instead. The point being is it's good for your health, and that's well known. And hopefully with your mindfulness you can feel that. You can feel things like relax. And as you relax, the tension, the tightness in your mind disappears. And your body feels just so good, so nice, so free. You've had a great health retreat as well as a mind retreat. Those are some of the benefits you have. So it also means that whenever you get into any medical crisis in your life, it may be a heart attack, it may be sort of a road accident, whatever it is, like I mentioned, I think, in one of the stories, about that sister of a monk who got shot in New York by a rapist. Actually, they found that rapist later on, had a shootout with the police and killed him. He's a very, very dangerous man. She was very lucky to survive. If she hadn't have run, she'd have been raped and then shot. So she ran, she was shot, and she managed just to survive because of her meditation. So when you're in those sorts of crises, especially like accidents and things like that, just not getting into shock, just being peaceful, will probably save your life. Again, I'm not an expert on medicine. There's a couple of doctors here. But I remember before I became a school teacher, because I was teaching science, because the fellow students in our teaching class realized that one day some kid is going to put his fingers into the electric socket, or they're going to just tip over the glass of acid all over them. Something's going to go wrong sooner or later, especially in science, because there's so many dangerous things there. And so I said, look, well, at least we should have some first aid as part of our course. So we actually demanded just an afternoon of just basic first aid, so that when we were teachers, especially in science, if anything went wrong, we'd know what to do. If it's English or geography, there's no problem there, but science can be dangerous. Someone might blow themselves up, sometimes on purpose, in the chemistry lab. So what do you do? And I always remember this doctor came, this GP, and he's a great guy. Just obviously, he'd been in the business a long time. He was very, very cool. And he just sort of told us, I think that he had a white sheet, got a tiny thimbleful of blood, and just threw it over the sheet, just to show how much a tiny bit of blood just makes this big stain. To make the point, he said, look, if you see this big stain over this kid's body, his jacket soaked in blood, it's only a tiny bit of blood. Don't think that, he's got none left. So to make sure that we don't overreact. And I remember him always telling us this one good occasion to lie. He said, if you see someone in an accident and they really look a mess, you should always tell them, oh, you'll be all right, you'll be okay. It's only a scratch. Because if you say, oh my God, that's terrible. Oh, dear me. Ah. Then, of course, the person with those injuries starts to realize what's going on with them. They go into shock, and very often that kills them. Because the mental reaction to the injury is often what sort of causes the death. If you just say, oh, that's okay, just a scratch, it doesn't feel so bad. I know that's happened to you. It certainly happened to me. I remember once on Arms Round in Thailand once, I stepped on a nail, a rusty old nail, and it went a couple of inches into my foot. Really deep puncture. I never felt anything. I just looked at it, oh, that's interesting. And this was quite equanimous with it. Until the monk with me said, oh my goodness, look at that. And at that, ah, it started to hurt. I started to get afraid. If he'd have just shut up, I'd have been okay. Which actually shows you what actually shock is. Just how the mind just can add to it or can subtract from it. And so being a meditator is amazing. Just how peaceful you can become. How quiet. Yet another of the stories that when I was in Thailand, we had this spate of buses bursting into flames because they were very poorly maintained. And there's a bit of oil leak here and oil leak there, and those old buses in Thailand. And they'd been in the newspapers and on the radio and even on the TV, because sometimes this old bus was going along the road, it would burst into flames, and sometimes people couldn't get out in time. They died. And one of my fellow monks had been on one of those buses. Everyone managed to go out, but he lost all his possessions. They all got burnt because he got some compensation from the bus company for a new pair of sandals. I think that's all they give. Little something. And so I don't know why it is. They all seem to happen in a spate. And this was at that particular time. And I was in a bus going in the northeast of Thailand somewhere, and someone screamed in the back, fire, fire! And so the bus driver slammed on the brakes really hard. Now, the thing is, in these buses in Thailand, the monks always sit in the front. The reason why they sit in the front is because of protection. It's like, you know, you have airbags, but it's not like the mics are sort of soft. It's just their good karma is like a sort of airbag. So, you know, the good karma is in the front over there, so if anything hits them head on, it's got to hit the mic first of all, and it can't do that because the mic's got good karma, so we protect everyone behind. So the theory goes. I tried that theory on Singapore Airlines, Qantas and Thai Airways to get us to sit in the front in first class, because that way our good karma will protect everyone else behind, but they don't buy that argument anymore. After sitting in economy. But nevertheless, we're sitting in the front there, next to another mic. I was by the window seat, he was by the aisle seat. Slammed on the brakes. And, you know, it sounded fire. And as soon as, actually before it stopped, just everybody just crowded into that aisle trying to get out. It's only a narrow entrance at the front. As for the driver, he was out the window. And as for the monk sitting next to me, he was pushing his way out as well. Now, you know, because of our rules as monks, especially the Northeast Thai monks, we're not even supposed to come into physical contact with a woman. So, you know, you just stay behind. If there's a couple of men, you can get in, get out that way. But as for him, no, he was right out. He didn't mind about touching anybody. And all the other people, they rushed out. And I didn't understand what was going on because they didn't read the newspapers. I didn't, you know, see the TV or listen to the radio. I hadn't heard all these cases of buses exploding spontaneously into flames. So I was sitting there wondering what the heck was going on. And while I was sitting there, everyone was going out, and I was just about to get up my seat and go out myself. I was not the last one out, but there's another fellow who was actually looking at the smoke in the back. And he shouted out, "It's only a cigarette, only a cigarette." And he sort of stamped it out. It wasn't a real fire, just a cigarette smoke, that's all. And so everybody was really relieved. And the monk who was sitting next to me came back in very embarrassed. But everyone, because I was sitting in the front, everyone had to pass me as they went in. And they were going, "Oh, you're such a brave monk. Oh, you're so enlightened. Oh, you're so wonderful." It was really nice. But really the truth was I was just stupid, that's all. I didn't know what was going on. So sometimes you can't tell much difference between being cool and being stupid. But if you were meditating, again, you wouldn't really mind. You'd just leave it alone and not overreact. And because you don't overreact, usually everything goes right. If you do overreact, you usually get into trouble. So your meditation, what you're doing here, learning how to let go, you can't do anything. Just relax, let it be. And you find that that's the best way of survival in life. Many occasions where other people get into trouble, you don't. Even other times when people die, you survive. Because you don't overreact. So often in life, it's panic which causes people to die. Remember, even that when our first year in our monastery, Bodhinyana Monastery, we had to do some explosions to get some caprock out. And in those days, you know, before terrorists, you know, you could mess around with the things yourself. And so messing around with this jet ignite, I mean, there's a guy who knew what he was doing there, you know, thank goodness. But one piece of advice he always told us, he said, "Look, if you ever get into trouble, never run. You always walk away. Because it's when people run, that's when they trip over, they break a leg, and that's when they can't go any further, and that's where they get killed. It's just like a basic rule when you're doing any explosive works. Never run." And that's why you always remember that, because it's so never panic, no matter what's happening. It's the panic which causes the problems and causes the deaths. But it's hard to do, isn't it? You know, when something terrible is happening, not to panic. So this is actually why we learn meditation, just to keep things cool, to let it go, let it be. It doesn't matter what's going to happen. You're going to die anyway. So what the worst can happen to you? You know, that's Ajahn Chah's saying, whenever he used to go and visit somebody in hospital, when he came to visit me in hospital, when I had that typhus fever, you felt really terrible, especially with that nurse built like a water buffalo stabbing you twice a day. And when he came in, you can imagine what it's like to see this great monk, Ajahn Chah, come to see you. And you're sort of this tiny, newly ordained monk, and a great teacher, and so busy, had the time to come and visit you. And as soon as he walked into that ward, I just felt so good. You felt elated. It's like being visited by the Queen or by some enormous great personality you really respected and loved. But the euphoria only lasts until he opens his mouth. And he told me what he tells many monks, apparently when they went sick in hospital. He said, Brahma one, sir, you'll either get better or you'll die. And then he turned around and went out again. Thank you very much. It's true, though, isn't it? You either get better or you die. That's Dhamma, that's true. The point was, you don't have to suffer that much longer. You either get better and the pain and the disease will go, or you'll die. Either way, the sucking doesn't last. It's quite reassuring when you think about it. So you keep it easy, you keep it peaceful, you don't let these things really upset you in life. And because of that, your survival rate increases. This is what actually somebody told me in Malaysia some years ago. They were a doctor, an oncologist, and they told me just how the Buddhists survived much better than the Christians and the Muslims at that time. Especially the meditators, simply because they were peaceful. They didn't overreact to the diseases of cancer or whatever else happened. Of course they died, but they didn't seem to die so much, and they never struggled at the very end. They could really let go and be at peace. Even like you think like a Christian, a Muslim, a Jew who believes in God, and who believes and they've done some good things, they're going to go to heaven, you think they wouldn't struggle at all. But it's the same why you struggle sometimes when you meditate. We can't stop getting interfering with what's going on. We can't just let go and let the process happen. But here in this meditation, you're learning how to do that. Just to make peace with every moment, even the unpleasant moments. So that way, by learning how to make peace in this meditation retreat, you can actually learn to make peace with all the sicknesses and even the pains which come at sickness. And even with the prospect that you're soon to die. So it'd be great, you know, if the Muslim community, the Christian community, the Jewish community, the Hindu community could actually also learn this way of letting go. So they can all die very peacefully. It's a wonderful gift to have. We're all going to do it one day. We might as well train for it now. So there's many benefits of this meditation retreat which happen in your life. But people say, oh yeah, all those things. What about the ordinary life, like going to work and making a living? Even with that, the meditation really helps. Simply because you get a sharper mind, a clearer mind. Because there's a couple of doctors in here. Sometimes you're faced with a patient, you've got all these symptoms, you've got to make a diagnosis. And sometimes your diagnosis can be the difference between life and death. So how do you make those diagnoses? Sure, you've got all the information in your head from your experience and from the books. But you know, sometimes the books aren't right. Sometimes the experience hasn't gone that far. And you're faced with a very difficult situation. What do you do? What actually is this disease? It's amazing that when you know how to meditate, you can get your mind so still and so peaceful. You can see deeper into the problems than other doctors can. Instead of stopping at the words and the descriptions you've had in the books, you can actually almost feel what the problem is. This thing we call intuition, clear seeing, often arises in silence. It's wonderful just how that happens. You just stop, make the mind peaceful, completely let go. Don't even worry about trying to find a solution to the problem. And these things, they just appear in the mind. And very often they're true and they're accurate. The first thing which comes up. So you actually, if you're a doctor, you can see through the problem in a much deeper, intuitive, you might even call a psychic way, because your mind has been trained in deep meditation. That's not just diagnosing problems in a patient. If you're in business, you can diagnose problems in the stock market. I mentioned this one fellow who had this very good meditation, and he literally did make a fortune in the stock market. He knew what stocks were going up and what were going down. So if you really develop your meditation that deeply, Buddhist society would like 10% again. I'm only joking. So the point being here is that you get more skill, more insight, more depth into whatever you're doing. And in the competitive business world, you can be more successful, more efficient. whenever you have any big problem or big deal to make or whatever else it is, when you have stress in your business life, in your work life, you try so hard, that again is when we make mistakes. You're just trying too hard, forcing the issue. But you know, when you relax and you're at ease, you usually can see through the problem and you're far better at whatever you're doing. Somebody told me that in, I think it was here, in one of the first interviews, just even in sport. I think their brother is a football player or something. And so sometimes the football players, the first couple of years, they're really good. And after 2 or 3 years, they seem to lose their abilities. And apparently he was saying, and I really agree with this, he said that after a couple of years, they lose the enjoyment, they lose the fun in what they're doing. And they force the issue. They get into a bad space, or they, you know, they lose, don't score so many goals or whatever. They seem to have a loss of form, and they try so hard, which is why they never get out of that dip in their abilities. But as soon as they enjoy themselves, they're relaxing. As soon as they're enjoying relaxing, then they do well. They got the fun in the game again. That's the same with doing business, even if it's monk business. If I didn't enjoy myself when I gave these retreats, I'd give terrible retreats. If I didn't enjoy myself as a monk, I'd be a hopeless monk. But when you enjoy yourself, you really relax, your energies come up, and you can usually perform to a much higher standard. So that when you're in your business life, again, just learning how to keep this meditation going, putting fun into what you're doing. Because, you know, you've seen by what I've, maybe not what I've said specifically, but certainly the way I've run this retreat, there's been a lot of fun and games, a bit of laughter, even the way I ding the bell every time, I try and make it different every time, just to have a bit of fun. And that's the way you run a retreat. That's the way you run your life. So don't make it too seriously. Always put a bit of play into whatever you're doing. And that way, you'll become more efficient, better at whatever you're doing, and more successful in life. But not only that, you have your relationships to deal with as well. Many of you aren't monks or nuns. You're not single, and you're going to go home to the crooked, one of the crooked things. Same goes for a wife as well, if you're a husband, and your family, and your kids, and all these other responsibilities. But you find that when you learn how to meditate, you can learn how to let go and be at peace. You can actually listen, rather than always reacting. How many of you have tried to have a conversation with your partner? They never listen, they only react. They do things. How many of you want to tell them something and they just give you a solution? They're just doing things. They're not really accepting. They're not passive. They're not listening. They're not being there. And this is a problem with relationships. So here in this meditation, you're learning about the essence of successful relationships. To be still. To listen. To accept. To embrace this moment or embrace that person you're with. As they are. Content. Appreciating the moment rather than always trying to make it different. It's the moments of appreciation of each other, of the moment, which make for a successful relationship. Not so much as striving to try and get somewhere else. So see if you can actually practice what you've learned in this meditation the same way which produces this wonderful sense of a peaceful, beautiful breath. You just relax and let it happen. You can relax in your relationships. Not trying to make it different. For those of you who got really inspired and say, oh, what am I going to do with my wife? I want to become a monk. What am I going to do with my husband? Oh my goodness, he won't let me become a nun. Be quiet and just make peace with your life as it is. Don't strive. When you make peace, and just say, okay, husband, that's fine. Okay, wife, that's okay. When you make peace like that, you find that just whatever, that making that peace will lead to more peace in the home, and maybe probably might lead to coming to join a monastery one day, because you're not confronting your partner. You're not making them be like a donkey in the stubbornness of your partner. You're allowing them to be. I know this because Even though I'd never been married, I had relationships before I was a monk. But I remember just when I was a young monk, I was with this other senior monk, Ajahn Chakkara. I know you remember him. He was a very firm and very dominant on the surface. But of course, I learned how to get my way. Like anyone in a relationship should know how to do. Yeah, story of how I did this. Some of you have heard this before, but it's actually the insight, the wisdom which comes from meditation, how the mind works. You know, I've already taught you, about programming mindfulness. When you've got a problem in your meditation, just at a quiet time, usually when you start meditation, say, if I sort of get sleepy, this is what I'll do. If I get sleepy, this is what I'll do. If I get sleepy, this is what I'll do. And you program that, and then you forget it. But the mind always remembers. When you're about to get sleepy, that particular response starts to come up, and it comes up naturally. You don't have to think about it. It's your programming, your conditioning, your brainwashing. It's like hypnotism. And it works so well. So I decided to use this with the abbot, Ajahn Chakkara. Exactly the same process, but I used it on somebody else. What I did was, when I wanted to build a hut, because we were building all these huts in the monastery, and I'd say, can we build a hut over there? And he'd say, no, don't be ridiculous. That was his standard phrase, don't be ridiculous. For those of you who remember him. And what would you usually do there? You'd argue. Say, no, that's wrong. It's a good place for a hut. And he'd argue back. That's not good psychology. If you want to have a happy relationship with your abbot or with your wife, with your husband, you don't argue. You use psychology. It's much stronger. You're devious, not straight up. So I'd say, okay, and I would not push it. But what I did know, I'd programmed his mind. Whenever you make a suggestion like that, people think about it afterwards. They don't admit they're thinking about it. Sometimes they don't even know they're thinking about it. But it's turning over inside their brain. And I'd usually have to reinforce it about a week or two later. I deliberately choose a time, maybe 10 days, 2 weeks, when I thought he'd forgot it, because other things come into his mind. And then I'd say again, you know, I think we should build a hut on the hill. It'd be a good place for a hut. Often he would say, that's a silly idea, don't be ridiculous. And he'd say it as if it was the first time I'd mentioned it, because he'd forgotten I'd mentioned it 10 days before, because I wouldn't push it. I'd say, okay, fair enough. And you wouldn't believe how successful this was. 1 or 2 weeks later, we'd be walking somewhere, and he'd just come up to me and say, you know, I think we should build a hut on the hill over there. He'd say it. And I'd always make sure that, you know, he'd never sussed out what was going on. I always said to him, hey, you know, I agree with you. That's a good idea of yours. And it worked. It's incredibly how good that is. Because number one, you can't force a person to make a decision, not subconsciously. Because just the ego, the self, I'm in control. Okay, so I'm going to make my decisions. I'm the abbot, I'm the boss, I'm the husband. So you've got to recognize that, the ego, you know, the sense of control. But you also recognize you put an idea in there and they'll think about it subconsciously. And if it's a good idea, if it really has merit, they will see that after a while. And so turning over in there, and one day an idea will come up. Hey, why don't we build a hut on the hill there? Hey, that's a really good idea of mine, I think. And then when they actually come and tell you, to make sure you can do this again, so you don't, you know, only can do this once, don't say, oh, actually, that's what I told you 2 times, remember? No. Don't say that. Just let them get away with it. They think it's their idea, and that's it. And it understands the nature of the will and conditioning. You think that you decide to come to this retreat. I put that conditioning into you a long time ago. I said, why don't you go on a retreat? No. Why didn't you go on a retreat? No. And then suddenly say, I think I'm going to go on a retreat. I said, lovely, you come on a retreat. That's why, you know, people like these two monks and Sister Seri and Sui Ping become nuns and monks. Put this idea, when you become a monk? Say, oh no, it's too difficult. Okay, never mind. Really powerful. And even though you know it, you'll forget. and I'll still get my own way with you. So this is actually how it works with conditioning. And when you really get into this meditation, you get all these great insights which help you in life. You can use that, if not on your partner in life, on your children. You know, sometimes our children can be just so reluctant to do what they're told. I think I did mention the story about Nasruddin and the salt bags. Children are so reluctant to do what they're told. They have to use psychology on them. And I've taught many sort of parents to get around their children by using such psychology. And it works really wonderfully well. All you need to do is actually just to know their weak points. One of the people that many of you know him, his youngest son was always just the scallywag. Would never actually, you know, send him to university. Do okay at school, just go to university. I think I had to pay for him to go to university. Because he didn't get sort of the enough marks. And it was always, you know, hardly going to the lectures and just not really doing the work. Only just barely making the grades. And just going out every night. And so, you know, he sort of thought about it, or rather reflected. Okay, instead of actually going the normal way of just telling his son, look, you better sort of work harder. I'm paying for this university. You've got to get a job later on. Work, study. He was smart. He waited one evening to when he was coming home and with his girlfriend. He'd been going out with her for a while. And he waited about 1 o'clock and 2 o'clock by the door. And so when they drove in, he was waiting. He said, come in. And of course, both of them were terrified. Ah! Now, my dad's waiting for us. And they sort of got them inside and gave them a nice cup of tea or something to drink. And then he didn't talk to his son. He started talking to his son's girlfriend. He said, if you don't mind me saying, I've seen you going out together for quite a while now. And I don't know, you know, what your relationship is. But, you know, it might happen that one day, you know, you might like to marry my son. But I just want to let you know that, you know, his grades are really bad at university. And he's not doing all that well. Because he's staying out too late at night. And talking to the girl, completely ignoring his son. So his girl's saying, hey, that's right, yeah, you know, I don't want to marry an idiot. I want to get sort of a guy who's got a good salary. Yeah. And so from that time on, he'd always come home at a good time. Because his girlfriend would say, time to get back. You've got to go to university in the morning. And the girlfriend could do whatever he wanted with him. Not his father. So you can see the weak point in that person. And use that weak point. And you can manipulate people whatever way you wish. That's all because you get the insight from meditation. I can let you into this secret because we don't have working bees at our monastery anymore. In the first years of our monastery, because we didn't have many sort of anagarikas and novices and things, there's only myself and Ajahn Jocko basically. We used to have these working bees. So you get all these people over there, but we found the best way to get the work out of, usually the men came and sort of did the digging and the hoeing and the wheelbarrowing. We'd always make sure we got lots of Thai girls, the young ones, and make sure they dressed up, all lots of makeup and scent. And we deliberately sort of invited them, come and have a look at the work. And as soon as they appeared, the men were really digging hard, something really hard. It's male nature. They always like to impress. They can't help themselves. Yeah, give them some water. And give them, say, here, have some water. Oh, thank you very much. Dig, 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 dig. They really got a lot of work done that way. So even though the Thai girls never actually did anything, they just stood there. But they were important. So once you understand human nature, you know, through your insight, through observation, through just being still and noticing what's going on. It's amazing what you can do in life. So what we're saying here is all your things which you learn in meditation, it's not just for the sake of nirvana. It's also on the way. You learn so much and life becomes more fun, more easy, and more productive. So Buddhism is not like a do-nothing, lazy religion. You get a lot more done in your life. And the old saying is, when there's something to be done, give it everything you've got. And that's why when I chant, I give it everything I've got. When I give a talk, give it everything I've got. When I meditate, I give meditation everything I've got. That's the creed for life. Whatever you're doing, give it everything you've got. If you're laughing, you know, go for it. Have a big belly laugh, everything you've got. But if you're really sad and you want to cry, cry! If you're crying everything you've got, really go for it. Don't sort of, you know, a little bit of a cry because you feel a bit embarrassed what other people are saying. That's not right. Just go for it. Just weep. Wah, wah. Whatever you're doing, put all your full effort into it. And you find that if you do that in your daily life, if you're working, give it everything you've got, you'll find that the next time you come on retreat, the retreat's really easy. Just something I found out for myself, because when I was in Thailand, you didn't have to do much work. You can meditate a lot. It's very nice. As soon as I came to Australia, the first few months, we were looking for the land. We were staying in North Perth. That was a great time, too. You could meditate a lot. Wasn't doing very much. But as soon as we got our land for our monastery, that was it. Work, work, work. And I really did work hard in that place. From dawn till you couldn't see in the evening. Day after day. It was really hard slog. And so it wasn't much time to meditate. When you did meditate, you felt so tired. You were just nodding meditation. You tried to struggle through it. And I realize now that was a stupid thing to do. But, you know, this is because you're working hard. That's all it was. Physical tiredness. Nothing else. But then there came the time when, you know, we had a bit of a break and no work. And I was really surprised because, you know, after maybe one day you'd rest a little bit. The next day you were back into deep meditation. And I couldn't figure out why it was I could recover so quickly. Why I'd be working for months and then suddenly you stop and you're straight back in there, just about. And it was only much later when you actually reflect on what's going on, you realize, when I was working, I gave everything I've got. Full attention, full mindfulness, full effort. Working, that's all I did, just work. Not complaining, not thinking about when it's going to be finished. All those techniques I learned when I was working were the techniques which brought success in meditation. Applying your attention 100%. Putting effort into what you're doing. Giving 100%. Just being in the moment. One pick at a time. Only when I finish this bit would I even think of the next one. Never planning ahead, but being in the moment. By doing that, I found I was actually building up what I call the muscles of meditation in the busy life I was leading at the time. So when you do give whatever you're doing 100%, whatever that is in your life, you'll find you're not neglecting your meditation. You're not abandoning the path. You're actually building up those same qualities to a great degree of strength so that when you stop, they're there for you. The same way you write your letters on the computer. Full mindfulness, full alertness. The same way you watch your breath in meditation. Full alertness, full mindfulness. In the moment, being with where you are. You find your work, your meditation, start to come together. So there's not that much difference if you know how to work, if you know how to run relationships, run businesses, look after your patients, or look after your own body. If you really know what meditation is, the two come together. So it doesn't need to be such a great change when you go out there into the world. Surely you don't get the depths of meditation you get here, but you still keep those muscles very fit. And so when you come to the next retreat, whenever that is, wherever that is, you'll spend one or two days just being tired as you rest and allow the energies to go back into the mind. And then you can give letting go everything you've got. Sit down here, forget completely about the world and just have meditation in your mind. In the same way that when you're working, saying do some carpentry, your mind is completely on that piece of wood, that plank of wood, and nothing else exists for you in the whole universe. That's how you focus. If you're doing an operation, just your mind is on the edge of that scalpel, and nothing else exists. This is how we focus, one thing at a time, giving everything we've got. And you find, whether you're working, whether you're meditating, the same tools are being sharpened. So when you come on that retreat, you don't waste time. You go straight back, deep into meditation. reasonably quickly. So it means that meditation is there for you at any time. You have a few days off and go there and sit and go deep very quickly, even though you've been working hard before. It's easy to do once you know how. So you have to go out there to work in the world. I have to go out and to work in my monasteries. I'm sometimes more busy than you are. Remember once in Singapore, there's a time when I was giving a talk at the Harbour Pavilion. I think it was the Buddhist Union's 50th anniversary or something. After giving a talk on meditation, on letting go, one of the people in the audience asked the question. They say, "That's all very well, Ajahn Brahm. You're a monk. You don't live in the real world. Here in Singapore, it's so stressful. We have to work so hard. We have to struggle. The economy's not good at that moment. So it's really cutthroat. You know, we can't afford to do stuff like that." "It's all right for you, but you don't know what the real world is." "So," I said, "you've got it completely wrong." And I told him what I've been doing that day since I got up about 4 o'clock. And he was stunned how much I got through from 4 o'clock that morning until, was it 9, 10 o'clock that evening at this Harbour Pavilion. And then he stood there, put his hand up again and said, "Ajahn Brahm, I'd never expected a monk to work so hard as you do. But," he said, "until I heard that, I always thought one day I'll be a monk, but now no way." Oh dear, I lost another one there. So we do work very hard, but we know how to let go as well. And then it'll come to the end of your life sometime when you really have to let go, and it's most important. So in the meditation, you're learning how to let go of things. And you feel so much freer afterwards. We enjoy each other's company, and then we part. You part and say goodbye. You go off to Singapore, you go off to Terengganu, you go off to Sydney, someone else goes to England, someone else goes all over the place. But does it really matter? That's our life. Things come together. We enjoy each other's company, and then we part. Bye-bye. And that's all there is to life. So we learn about life, and we learn about meditation. The deepest truths of life, there we see them in our own heart. And it gives meaning to our existence. And understanding where we're coming from, who we are, and the big questions of life. And most important, your happiness. You find that happiness comes from the simple things of life. For peace. And that peace is always out there. It's always out there with the birds chirping. With the grass growing. So whenever you do have a few moments, just go out into the garden. Go out into the park. Sit down. Do nothing. If anyone asks you, "What are you doing?" You just say, "I'm just watching the trees grow." Trees do grow, you know. See if you can watch them grow. You have to be very patient and stay a long time before they grow, because they only grow a tiny bit. And if you just lose your mindfulness, you don't see them growing. So you've got to be very mindful and very calm to go and watch a tree grow. It's a good excuse for doing nothing. So spend your time watching the trees grow, especially if you work for calm. You can go and tell your boss, "I'm just going to watch the trees grow." That's what I'm supposed to do. I'm a forestry department. So that's a way of doing nothing. And not only do you see the trees grow outside, you see the Bodhi tree grow inside. The Bodhi tree of wisdom, peace, awakening, enlightenment. So when you just go out and do nothing, you are watching the trees grow. The Bodhi tree of wisdom inside of you. And may that Bodhi tree grow and shade you and all out your sentient beings with a lot of happiness. You see those trees, so many birds nest in those trees. So many animals partake of the tree's fruits, and even human beings use its wonderful shade. So you be a Bodhi tree, a resource and a refuge for so many sentient beings, and a source of shade for all your disciples. So have some refuge from the searing heat of competitive life. Be the Bodhi tree. Okay, that's the final instruction. Now, what did I say about if you're going to do it properly? Ah! There we go. That's much better. See, it's much more fun when you play around. Okay, any questions about the talk this morning about... Well, if you don't figure it out and you don't die properly, you have to come and do it all over again. I just say, oh, okay, who cares? If I live, I live. I die, I die. Whatever happens. You make up your mind, body. I've given up trying. So the thing is, you're not dead yet. So now it's a present moment, so enjoy this moment. Who knows what's going to happen next? I might die before you. In fact, you might be the last one on the planet Earth. Who knows what might happen? So we'll see what happens. The future is uncertain. But that way, you just don't worry about things. I know many people like that. There was this one person, they were very, very sick, went to see them a few times. And they came really close to death, but then they recovered again. They recovered for a while, and then so maybe a couple of months later, they went down and came very close. Everyone thought they would die. And in the end, I mean, I think he told me, he said his children came to him to tell him off. He said, look, every time you're about to die, we prepare ourselves. It's very hard, and we're ready for you to die. Then you go and get better. We have to do it all over again. Come on, Dad. It's true, isn't it? It's more, you know, people get used to you about to die, and they come and say goodbye, and they get themselves all ready and prepared to let you go. And then you come alive again. Very disconcerting. I say, you're going to do it properly. Make up your mind. So, now you're alive, now you're dying. Now you're... Okay. Any other questions before we go? Okay, what we're going to do now is, I did promise, if there's any emergency interviews, I'm going to go into the room over there. And it's no order, so you can sit on the chair outside. And it's once I finish with the person in there, then the person sitting in the chair goes in next. If you're really, really desperate, you can have a fight for the chair. Or grab him by the throat, take him outside, and you sit in the chair. No, don't do things like that. Then we'll see what happens. Okay, and so just come in pretty soon, because we're probably about 9 o'clock. What time is it now? Oh, it's 9 o'clock now, probably about 10 o'clock. I'll probably come in for a little sit. So only for the first hour. It's nice for me to have a nice little sit with you before lunch. And after lunch, it's like, you know, start to clean up your room if you have to, and then do your little jobs and duties. And then try and be back here by 1 o'clock. And at 1 o'clock, you know, a nice little talk, a nice meditation together, and finishing off with a loving kindness meditation, which I always like to do at the end of the retreat. And we finish off at 2 o'clock. And 2 o'clock, I give a little blessing. Somebody wants to give a little bit of some offering. And then after that, we can actually talk to each other, say goodbye to whatever we need to do. And then just we can very gradually, very slowly just drift away, each to our own places. That's the for this afternoon. Is that okay for everybody? Okay. Yeah, good question.
About how long do we need to be here to help clean up?
It doesn't take all that long after... But 2 o'clock, usually about quarter of an hour, because everyone gives a hand, usually. It doesn't take that long. Especially cleaning up your own room takes the time. You know, making sure everything is, as they say, just as it was when you left. And then getting all the stuff in the car. But what really takes time is because you've been together for such a long time, you haven't spoken to each other, you've been really good this retreat. And maybe because of that warning I gave about, you know, what happened to the last person who talked during a retreat. So what happens is that afterwards it's nice to talk to each other and say hello, find out who we are if you really want to, and then that's why usually people actually have a nice chat to each other, and sometimes that takes more time than cleaning up, and that's fine to do also. Any other questions about what's happening later on? Okay, that's later on. It's still 2 hours to lunch. 2 hours. And this might be your time. One of the days it is going to be your time. Enlightenment has to happen sooner or later. Otherwise, you have to keep getting reborn and getting right next time. One of these days, one of these moments, one of these mornings, it's going to happen. So, it could be the next 2 hours. When you least expect it, then it might happen. Okay? So, don't waste time. Don't go and sit in your room and start packing now. Plenty of time to do that. Now's the time to sit and walk and enjoy just the crescendo. You know when you used to listen to beautiful music? concertos and overture, symphonies. Just right at the very end, just builds up all this energy and all these movements. It suddenly comes together, the whole orchestra comes together at the very end. And that's usually the best part of the music, just right at the end. Sometimes you get your little records and you'd actually move it to the end straight away instead of going for the first part of the symphony, just to get the last piece, the last movement. That used to be really good. So this is, you've worked all that, all hard. You've come to the crescendo of this amazing 9-day symphony. Brahms. And now it's all come together for the final movement. Da, 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 da. So enjoy this last movement. Okay. So I'll go in the room now. Anyone wants to come in? And I won't open this card until after lunch. Shows restraint.